Good morning, and welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Ted O'Brien, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. Our speaker today is Professor Andrew Basevich, a retired United States Army officer, a veteran of two wars, and for 20 years, Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University, where he chairs the department. Andrew Basevich was graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1969 and earned master's and doctoral degrees from Princeton University in history and diplomatic history, respectively. Prior to coming to Boston University, Professor Basevich served 23 years on active duty, seeing combat in Vietnam and the first Gulf War before retiring as a colonel. He previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University. He is the author of numerous articles and books, including, among others, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country, published this year. America's Path to Permanent War in 2010, The Limits of Power 2008, and The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War, published in 2005. Andrew Basevich was an early and persistent critic of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, calling it a catastrophic failure. In March of 2007, he described George Bush's endorsement of such preventive wars as immoral, illicit, and imprudent. 2 months later, his only son, Lieutenant Andrew Basevich Jr., a soldier like his father before him, was killed fighting in Iraq. I first met Dr. Basevich in 2000 while producing a program for WBUR on the 25th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. He and a former Marine Sergeant, Carlo Durante, also from BU, spoke honestly and bluntly of their Vietnam experiences in a broken, drug-infested military in the final years of that conflict. He will be as bluntly honest today as he was then and in all the years between. Would you welcome, please, Andrew Basevich.
My remarks may be a bit too long, so let me jump right into this thing. It's really a great privilege to speak to the Lyceum, and my wife and I really, it's really a treat for us to visit Peterborough and certainly to be in this beautiful church. Now, the title of my presentation is called Cheap Grace and the American Way of War, and I think pretty quickly you'll figure out why I chose that title. When American soldiers deploy to places like Iraq and Afghanistan, what is the cause for which they fight? Patriotic answer is this: they fight for freedom. Challenge that proposition, and you'll likely pick a quarrel. Endorse it, and the conversation ends. What more is there to say? In fact, at least two elements of that assertion merit serious further examination. Does fighting as such actually contribute to freedom's preservation? And to what extent is freedom as actually exercised worth fighting for? This morning, I want to suggest that as far as the post-9/11 period is concerned, neither of those questions merits an affirmative answer. Yet we begin our inquiry, not in the present, but in the past, with a young German seeker after truth who found what he was looking for on 138th Street, in New York City. In his 1937 book, The Cost of Discipleship,
Dietrich Bonhoeffer, famously reflected on the difference between what he called cheap grace and costly grace. The distinction between the two defined the crisis confronting 20th century Christianity. Cheap grace served as a sort of self-replenishing debit card for the soul, allowing anything to be had for nothing. Cheap grace, wrote Bonhoeffer, is the grace we bestow on ourselves, unearned, allowing forgiveness without repentance, baptism without church discipline, communion without confession. Acquiring costly grace, in contrast, entails sustained effort. Costly grace, wrote Bonhoeffer, citing New Testament parables, is the, quote, treasure hidden in the field, or the pearl of great price. Rather than received passively, such grace has to be earned. In Adolf Hitler's Third Reich, church leaders specialized in dispensing cheap grace. As a consequence, the German church implicated itself in unspeakable crimes. Some churchmen courageously refused to conform, Bonhoeffer prominently among them. He became part of the anti-Hitler resistance, eventually joining the secret plot to assassinate Hitler. The unraveling of that plot led to his arrest, imprisonment, and eventual execution in April 1945. Now, this story of German martyrdom, inspiring in its own right, features an important American prelude. As it turns out, Bonhoeffer himself had not coined the phrase cheap grace. He had instead appropriated it. The concept originated in Harlem, which is where Bonhoeffer himself first encountered it. In 1930, Bonhoeffer had spent a year in residence at New York's Union Theological Seminary. Finding famous Manhattan churches like Riverside Congregational and Broadway Presbyterian to be liturgically insipid, Bonhoeffer set out in search of worship services more to his liking. That search led him uptown to 138th Street and the Abyssinian Baptist Church. Among the African Americans who worshiped there, Bonhoeffer found a community of believers pursuing a vision of what it means to live an authentically Christian life. Now, Abyssinian was the handiwork of Adam Clayton Powell Sr., the son of slaves, who after a misspent youth had become a dynamic preacher, critic of racism, and promoter of social justice and Christian ecumenism. The cheap grace that Reverend Powell denounced from his pulpit was the tendency of white Christians to turn a blind eye to American racism while still counting themselves as faithful followers of Jesus. When Bonhoeffer returned to Germany the following year, he carried Powell's concept of cheap grace with him. His critique of religion as a medium for unearned self-justification marked him as a troublemaker in the eyes of the Nazi regime. Yet if acutely relevant to Germany in the 1930s, Bonhoeffer's critique had a far wider application. Then and now, it applied to the United States. The penchant for unearned self-forgiveness that Reverend Powell diagnosed from his pulpit eventually spread through the American body politic. Since 9/11, it has reached pandemic proportions. For Reverend Powell, cheap grace allowed white Christian America to give itself a pass on race, a tendency that persists today. Yet of equal or greater moment, cheap grace permeates and perverts American statecraft, upholding claims of entitlement and a sense of innocent victimhood when those claims meet resistance. In exercising so-called global leadership, American policymakers outlining what the United States must do routinely speak as if they have an inexhaustible treasury upon which to draw. Conferring on the nation gratuitous blessings, they insist that America is doing God's work without offering evidence of God's assent or approval. Left unchecked, an indulgence in cheap grace induces a state akin to auto-intoxication. To consider the potential consequences, we need look no further than the fate befalling Bonhoeffer's Germany. During the Nazi era, the moral compass of the German people largely ceased to function. That Americans will, in a similar manner, lose their ability to distinguish between good and evil is by no means inevitable. Yet neither should that possibility be fully discounted. Ours, after all, is an age in which the United States engages in preventive war, and presidents order the extra-legal killing of U.S. citizens. Lending this present-day fondness for cheap grace an element of irony is the fact that it is not endemic to the nation's character. On the contrary, at crucial points in their history, Americans have abjured cheap grace in favor of the harder alternative. They paid. As a consequence, the nation reaped very considerable rewards. A necessary first step toward appreciating the corrupting and pernicious effects of cheap grace is to recall what costly grace once wrought. For Americans, the war against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan proved an occasion entailing the expenditure of costly grace. This was a war fought for freedom. Persuading Americans that this freedom at home obliged them to fight for freedom across the oceans required more than somber presidential reflections on God's purposes. So Franklin Roosevelt and his lieutenants shrewdly infused democratic considerations into their approach to waging war against the Axis. To a greater extent than any prior conflict, war became an indisputably communal undertaking. In a democracy, Undersecretary of War Robert Patterson declared in 1944, in a democracy, all nations have equal rights and equal obligations. A graduate of Harvard Law School, Patterson himself was a combat veteran of World War I. When the nation is in peril, he continued, the obligation of saving it should be shared by all, not foisted on a small percentage. With regard to obligations, if not rights, Patterson's axiom accurately describes the Roosevelt administration's approach to war. All would contribute to the cause, all would share in whatever burdens the war imposed, and all, or at least mostly all, could expect to share in the benefits. When it came to raising an army, therefore, shared obligation became a defining precept. Rather than relying on volunteers, the United States implemented a system of conscription. The draft took black and white, rich and poor, the famous and the obscure, Ivy Leaguers and high school dropouts. The sons of leading politicians like Franklin Roosevelt served, as did the sons of multimillionaires like Joseph P. Kennedy. Hollywood idols Douglas Fairbanks Jr., Henry Fonda, Clark Gable, Tyrone Power, James Stewart, most of us in this room remember those names, found themselves in uniform. So too did baseball stars Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, and Hank Greenberg, along with boxing greats Joe Louis and Gene Tunney. In other words, the United States waged World War II with a citizen army that reflected the reigning precepts of American democracy, not least of all in its adherence to Jim Crow practices. Service exacted sacrifice. Patterson's axiom applied across the board. Among the 400,000 American lives claimed in World War II were 19 players from the National Football League. Glenn Miller, America's most popular bandleader, was killed while serving with the U.S. Army Air Forces. Harvard University contributed its share. Inscribed on one wall of the university's memorial church are the names of 453 Harvard men who died in World War II. Just 35 fewer than the total number of West Pointers lost. The citizen army's strengths and its limitations as a fighting force both reflected and affirmed the civil-military contract forged for the duration, the essence of which was a widely shared determination to get the goddamn thing over with and go home. Such mundane aspirations did not imply a grant of authority allowing Roosevelt to expend American lives with abandon. Indeed, to assume otherwise would be to place his bargain with the American people at risk. Fortunately, circumstances did not require that Roosevelt do so, and more fortunately still, he and his advisors understood that. The outcome of World War II turned above all on two factors. In Europe, the durability and fighting power of the Red Army. In the Pacific, the weakness and vulnerability of the Japanese economy. To hit the perfect strategic sweet spot required the United States to exploit both of these factors. This Roosevelt admirably succeeded in doing. Success entailed, above all, making the most of America's comparative advantage, which lay in the production of war essential materiel. Whatever the category, no other belligerent could match the U.S. in productive capacity. Moreover, since the United States was and is difficult to attack and impossible to conquer, the American arsenal of democracy lay beyond the effective reach of Axis forces. In that regard, however much Anglophiles might swoon at Winston Churchill's inspiring rhetoric, in the eyes of America's senior war managers, Soviet fighting power mattered a great deal more than shared ideals. With France defeated and the British Empire short of will and wherewithal, the president looked to the Red Army to destroy the mighty Wehrmacht. The whole question of whether we win or lose the war depends on the Russians, FDR told Henry Morgenthau in June 1942. That same year, Admiral Ernest King, the chief of naval operations, assured reporters in an off-the-record briefing that, quote, Russia will do 9/10 of the job of defeating Germany. This distribution of effort, the Soviets doing most of the fighting, while drawing freely on the endless bounty of American farms and factories, showed itself most vividly when it came to casualties. U.S. battle deaths for the period 1941-1945 were hardly trivial. Yet compared to the losses suffered by the other major belligerents, the United States emerged from the war largely unscathed. Estimates of Soviet military losses, for example, range between 11 and 13 million. Add civilian deaths, 10 million more in the Soviet Union, a mere handful in the United States, and the disparity becomes greater still. To ascribe this disparity to the fortunes of war is to deny Roosevelt credit that is rightly his. The U.S. approach to waging war against Japan offered a variation on this theme. With opportunities for outsourcing that war less available and less desired, the United States shouldered the principal responsibility for defeating Japan. Yet the Japanese were as resource poor as the Americans were resource rich. When it came to industrial capacity, in comparison with the American colossus, Japan was a pygmy, its economy approximately 1/10 as large. In 1941, Japan accounted for 3.5% of global manufacturing output, the United States, 32.5%. And as the war progressed, this gap only widened. In any week of her war with Germany, between June 1941 and May 1945, writes the historian H.P. Wilmot, the Soviet Union, any week of the Soviet war with Germany, the Soviet Union lost more dead than the total American fatalities in the Pacific War, thereby succinctly expressing the genius of U.S. grand strategy in World War II. Now, many factors account for this disproportion, but among them were calculated choices made by FDR and his advisors. Give the Russians whatever they need to kill Germans. Engage the Wehrmacht directly in large-scale ground combat, only after it had been badly weakened. Fight the Japanese on terms that played to American advantages, expending materiel on a vast scale in order to husband lives. Our standard of living in peace, George C. Marshall declared in September 1939, our standard of living in peace is in reality the criterion of our ability to kill and destroy in war. Marshall adding, quote, present-day warfare is simply mass killing and mass destruction by means of machines resulting from mass production. Now, the unspoken corollary was this. In addition to limiting U.S. casualties, this preference for expending machines rather than men was going to produce positive effects on the home front. Even today, the numbers remain startling. Between 1939 and 1944, this nation's gross domestic product grew by 52% in constant dollars. Manufacturing output trebled. Despite rationing, consumer spending actually increased during the war. More remarkable still is this: the benefits of this suddenly restored prosperity were broadly distributed. To be sure, the rich became richer. Yet the non-rich also benefited, and disproportionately so. Families in the lowest quintile saw their incomes grow by 111%, and in the second lowest quintile by 116%. Between 1939 and 1944, the share of wealth held by the richest 5% of Americans actually fell from 23.7% to 16.8%. The war that had exhausted other belligerents and left untold millions in want around the world found Americans becoming not only wealthier, but also more equal. Notably, all of this happened despite or because of increased taxes. Americans paid more, and more Americans paid. In 1940, approximately 7% of Americans paid federal income taxes. By 1944, that figure had mushroomed to 64%. No one proposed that wartime might offer a suitable occasion for cutting taxes. Now, none of this is to imply that World War II was a good war, either on the fighting fronts or at home. Yet if not good, Roosevelt's war was surely successful. If the essential objective of statecraft is to increase relative power, thereby enhancing a nation's ability to provide for the well-being of its citizens, then U.S. policy during World War II qualifies as nothing less than brilliant. Through cunning and foresight, Roosevelt and his lieutenants secured for the United States the position of global preeminence while simultaneously insulating the American people from the worst consequences of the worst war in history. For the United States, World War II did not deliver something for nothing, but it did produce abundant rewards for much less than might have been expected. Furthermore, this collaboration between government and governed yielded more than victory abroad. At home, it dramatically enhanced the standing of the former while reinvigorating the latter. The Great Depression had undermined the legitimacy of the American political system, prompting doubts about the viability of democratic capitalism. World War II restored that legitimacy with interest. As a people, Americans emerged from the war, reassured that prosperity was indeed their birthright, and eager to cash in on all that the nation's arrival at the pinnacle of power promised. This is what costly grace purchased. Victory in 1945 propelled the nation to dizzying heights of power and prosperity. Yet Americans interpreted these as outward signs of something much more fundamental. In the victor's estimation, the war that destroyed the Axis had rendered a verdict of transcendent significance. The future belonged to freedom. And by extension, the future belonged to the nation and people most clearly expressing freedom's intentions. Here were the twin springs that for decades filled a reservoir of American confidence and self-regard. Roosevelt's successors drew on these war-fed reserves to justify a dizzying array of adventures and misadventures. From victory, in other words, came the sense of self-assurance, prerogative, and obligation that sustained America's hold on the summit of global power. Well, after September 2001, when George W. Bush inaugurated the global war on terrorism, he saw another such victory ahead, one that he expected to refurbish and restore the nation's sense of purpose. This time of adversity, the president declared in his 2002 State of the Union address, this time of adversity offers a unique moment of opportunity, a moment we must seize to change our culture. For too long, the president continued, our culture has said, if it feels good, do it. Now, he continued, America is embracing a new ethic and a new creed. Let's roll. In the sacrifice of soldiers, the fierce brotherhood of firefighters, and the bravery and generosity of ordinary citizens, we have glimpsed what a new culture of responsibility could look like, a nation that serves goals larger than itself. Well, no such transformation of American culture ensued. Indeed, the way President Bush chose to wage his war all but ensured a contrary result. In stark contrast to World War II, the war on terror depleted the nation's remaining stores of moral capital, leaving in its wake cynicism and malaise. It impelled the country on a downward rather than upward trajectory. Embarking upon what he himself unfailingly described as an enterprise of vast historic significance, Bush wasted no time in excluding the American people from any involvement in the events that ensued. Choosing war, he governed as if there were no war. "We have suffered a great loss," the president acknowledged in a nationally televised address shortly after 9/11, "and in our grief and anger, we have found our mission and our moment. We will rally the world to this cause by our efforts, by our courage. We will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail." But who exactly was this we? To whom was the president referring in his repeated and fervent use of the first person plural? It soon became apparent that Bush's we was little more than a rhetorical device. Minimizing collective inconvenience rather than requiring collective commitment became the distinctive signature of his approach to war management. Bush wanted members of the public to carry on as before. After all, to suspend the pursuit of individual happiness, defined in practice as frantic consumption, was to hand the terrorists a victory. So within 3 weeks of the 9/11 attacks, the president was urging his fellow citizens to, quote, "fly and enjoy America's great destination spots." And to facilitate such excursions, he persuaded Congress to enact further tax cuts. Well, here was cheap grace, tied up with a patriotic bow and handed down from on high. To purchase support for, or acquiescence in, the nation's mission of advancing the cause of human freedom, the administration, with congressional approval, distributed bonuses. Americans had a little difficulty deciphering the president's cues. In short order, the we called upon to advance the cause of human freedom took a backseat to the we preferring to enjoy life. Thus encouraged, Americans disengaged from the war, leaving to others the task of waging it. Within a matter of months, Americans had settled on three first-person plural axioms to describe the parameters of their wartime role. First, we will not change. Second, we will not pay. Third, we will not bleed. According to the first axiom, Americans refused to permit war to exact demands. According to the second, Americans rejected any responsibility to cover the financial costs entailed by war's conduct. According to the third, actual participation in war became entirely a matter of personal choice. War imposed no collective civic responsibility other than to signal appreciation for those choosing to serve, this easily achieved without violating principles one or two. As long as it agreed to abide by these proscriptions, Washington could pretty much make war wherever it wanted, more or less assured of at least tepid popular acquiescence. This defines the chief accomplishment of George W. Bush after 9/11. The bottom line is this: invited to indulge in cheap grace, Americans willingly comply. Virtually from the outset, George W. Bush's global war on terrorism was never really America's war, in the sense that FDR's war had been. It was, and in some quarters at least was intended to be, Washington's war. So despite the lofty freedom agenda described by Bush, the conflict almost immediately became, and thereafter remained, a third-person plural enterprise. They fought while we watched, uninvolved and seemingly uninfected. The fighting they were American soldiers, members of an institution that by the beginning of the 21st century existed at considerable remove from the rest of society. With something approaching unanimity, ordinary citizens professed fervent admiration for the nation's warriors. Yet admiration did not imply understanding, much less intimacy. The actually existing relationship between soldiers and society tended to be long on symbolism and short on substance. So when it came to fighting and dying, we not only got a free pass, we could feel good about it. Courtesy of the Bush administration's tax policies, moreover, that free pass extended to defraying the war's financial costs. The obligation to pay for the global war on terrorism fell on a second they, future generations of taxpayers, oblivious to the fate awaiting them. George W. Bush had inherited from his predecessor a balanced federal budget. After 9/11, increased military outlays combined with tax cuts drove that budget into the red. There it stayed. For fiscal year 2009, the year Bush left office, the federal deficit reached a staggering $1.4 trillion. Over the two terms of his presidency, the total size of the national debt had more than doubled, ballooning from $3.3 trillion to $7.5 trillion. Worse, trillion-dollar annual shortfalls thereafter became routine. Outsourcing war's conduct to a small warrior class, less than 1% of the total population, evoked occasional twinges of discomfort. Could such an approach to war fighting comport with authentic democratic principles? Obliging generations unborn to foot the bill for wars in which they had no voice elicited similar expressions of concern. Were such arrangements consistent with the basic requirements of fairness? Such qualms of conscience did not produce action, however. No longer seeing war as an enterprise requiring collective effort on a national scale, adamant in their refusal to curb their penchant for consumption, Americans swallowed hard, averted their gaze from the consequences of actions undertaken in their name, and carried on as if there were no war. This post-9/11 approach to conducting war, the country more or less AWOL, while the state does what it pleases, raises troubling moral and ethical concerns. Yet in any evaluation of the global war on terrorism, the overriding question is necessarily this one. Has a decade and more of armed conflict enhanced the well-being of the American people? Is war making the United States more powerful and more prosperous? Now, if the answer to these questions is affirmative, then moral and ethical misgivings might figure as a matter of academic debate, but they won't really matter. Yet evidence supporting an affirmative answer is difficult to locate. Indeed, such evidence does not exist. Consider the economy. In American political discourse, crisis ranks alongside historic at the very top of the list of overused terms. Yet the Great Recession that began in 2007, coinciding with the surge that was ostensibly salvaging the Iraq War, the Great Recession was the real deal, a crisis of historic proportions. As the ongoing global war on terrorism approached the 10-year mark, the U.S. economy had shed a total of 7.9 million jobs in 3 years. For only the second time since World War II, the official unemployment rate topped 10%. And the retreat from that peak has come at an achingly slow pace. By some estimates, actual unemployment, including people who simply gave up looking for work, was double the official figure. As an immediate consequence, millions of Americans lost their home. Countless more were thrown into poverty, the number of those officially classified as poor reaching the highest level since the Census Bureau had begun tracking such data. Inequality reached gaping proportions, with 1% of the population having amassed a full 40% of the nation's wealth. Now, only time will tell whether Americans were able to shake their apathy and reverse indicators pointing to national decline. Rather than attempting a definitive judgment, the aim here is to posit an additional line of inquiry, suggesting a direct link between the problems besetting the American way of life and the shortcomings evident in the contemporary American way of war. Put simply, to a considerable extent, the latter have begotten the former. Or, to put it another way, cheap grace turns out to be not all that cheap. It ends up exacting costs of its own. The crux of the problem lies in these two symmetrical 1%. The one whose members get sent to fight seemingly endless wars, and the other whose members demonstrate such a knack for enriching themselves. Needless to say, the two 1% neither intersect nor overlap. They exist world apart from one another. Few of the very rich send their sons and daughters to fight. Few of those leaving the military's ranks find their way into the ranks of the plutocracy. Yet a people who permit war to be waged in their name while offloading onto a tiny minority responsibility for war's actual conduct have no cause to complain about an equally small minority milking the system for all it's worth. Crudely put, if the 1% who are rich are engaged in ruthlessly exploiting the 99% who are not rich, their actions are analogous to that of American society as a whole in its treatment of soldiers. The 99% who do not serve in uniform just as ruthlessly exploit the 1% who do. To excuse or justify their unconscionable conduct, the very rich engage in acts of philanthropy. With a similar aim of excusing or justifying their equally unconscionable conduct, the not-so-rich proclaim their undying support for the troops. Both of these are exercises in dispensing cheap grace. Well, as the bumper sticker rightly proclaims, freedom isn't free. Conditioned to believe that the exercise of global leadership is essential to preserving their freedom, conditioned further to believe that leadership expresses itself in the wielding of military might, Americans have begun to discover that trusting in the present-day American way of war to preserve the present-day American way of life entails exorbitant and unexpected costs. Among the most obvious are high unemployment, gaping inequality, massive federal deficits, and soaring national debt, not to mention the countless billions squandered by U.S. forces seeking to extricate themselves from wars they have proven unable to win. Yet as painful as they are, these costs symbolize something far more disturbing. As a remedy to all the ailments afflicting the American body politic, war, at least war as Americans have chosen to wage it, turns out to be a fundamentally inappropriate prescription. Rather than restoring the patient to health, war as currently practiced, pursuant to freedom as currently defined, constitutes a form of prolonged ritual suicide. Rather than building muscle, it corrupts and putrefies. Rather than purging, it poisons. Returning home from New York, in the 1930s, Bonhoeffer mourned what he called the millions of spiritual corpses who filled German churches while allowing others to pervert German culture and politics. So too in the America of our own day, spiritual corpses abound. The choice Americans seemingly face today ends up being as straightforward as it is stark. If on the one hand, they believe war essential to preserving their freedom, then it's incumbent upon them to prosecute war with the same seriousness that their forebears demonstrated in the 1940s. Washington's war would then truly become America's war, with all that implies in terms of commitments and priorities. Should, on the other hand, Americans decide that freedom as presently defined is not worth the sacrifices entailed by real war, then it becomes incumbent upon Americans to revise their understanding of freedom, settling for something less. Either choice, real war or a more constrained conception of freedom, would entail the expenditure of costly grace. Yet the dilemma that I've just described may in fact be more theoretical than real. Having forfeited any responsibility for war's design and conduct, the American people may find that Washington considers that grant of authority irrevocable. Put simply, the state now owns war, with the country consigned to observer status. The American future may be one in which real, if futile, sacrifices, exacted of the few who fight, serve chiefly to facilitate metaphorical death for the rest of us who do not. And on that note, I will conclude. Thank you for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Professor Basevich. I think I speak for all of us when we think you did a marvelous job.